Welcome to The Wrap-Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me is my co-host, Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Welcome, Daniel.
Hey, Sharon, how's your week going so far?
Not too bad, except for, you know, trying to keep up with all the exposés going down.
That's the new thing, right?
The exposé. Yeah.
Speaking of which,
this week, there was a big one. The LA Times revealed a whole bunch of allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct at ICM Partners, which is one of the top talent agencies in Hollywood. For many, however, the allegations were far from earth-shattering, and it left them wondering, is this going to result in a seismic shift at the culture of Hollywood agencies, or will it just produce a slight tremor? We'll talk with The Wrap's Beatrice Verhoeven and Alberto Gonzalez, who've done a bunch of interesting reporting on that question.
Plus, Donald Trump's Facebook ban will remain in place, but the social media giant left a lot unanswered when it comes to his future on the platform. The Wrap's tech reporter, Sean Birch, will join us to explain. But first, Sharon, let's get into some headlines.
Let's do it.
So the question is, has the Hollywood Foreign Press Association finally solved their massive image problem? After getting dumped by their diversity and inclusion advisor and a top-notch crisis PR firm on the same day, the group behind the Golden Globes unveiled a sweeping reimagining of the organization on nearly every level, which the membership overwhelmingly approved on Thursday. The group committed to elect a new board, hire professional executives, and adopt a new set of membership criteria, including eliminating its Southern California residency requirement, and, I thought this was the biggest one, no longer accepting promotional items. So all of this to me finally feels like the kind of thing that the group should have been saying months ago. Sharon, do you think this latest attempt at reform will do the trick?
I mean, I don't think anyone can say right now whether this will be definitively enough or not. It does adopt some of the things that were demanded of the HFPA in this whole sort of directive essentially from Time's Up, which has no standing with anyone. They are just an activist organization making recommendations. But it did reflect, you know, deep knowledge of the problems and an awareness of what drives the corruption at the organization. So it could get them over the hump. I don't think that doubling the membership is so unbelievable. There's only 87 members. That means you get to, somebody do the math for me, not quite 180.
174.
Yeah. And then you end up with, some diversity among that group of new people. Cool. But it's certainly the minimum they needed to do to not just completely melt down and become like the, you know, Wicked Witch of the West and just be a pile of puddle with their broomstick next to them.
Yeah, it's a little surprising it took this long for them to dig in a little bit deeper to some of the problems that they had.
Well, they didn't have any leadership. As we've been reporting ad nauseum, as the people internally have been leaking to us, as people who know the group on the outside have been saying publicly, they have had no leadership, and that you've had the same group of people who have been accused of all the corruption and of creating a culture of exclusion, okay, are the ones who have been given the mandate to change, which means like basically fire yourself, reapply, get off the gravy train. And you're like, really, do I have to? Yeah, you really have to, or all of this goes away for everybody. Sorry to break it down like that, but that's essentially what it was.
Yeah, I think
that is.
I think they're getting to the heart of some of the problems, and they're sort of hitting at every level, right? They're not just saying like, oh, we need to get a few more members. They're saying, okay, we need to do this. We need to get the board, you know, into a position that makes more sense. And they're going to cycle people in, it seems like, a little more frequently. You're not just going to be a board member forever. And, you know, they're just getting rid of certain residency requirements.
Yeah. The problem is not being a board member forever. It's more around
a lot of levels.
Yeah. The board membership was more like a round robin. You'd have this group of people who would just cycle in and out. So they did turn the board over, but the problem was the new people who want reform. And there is a whole kind of constituency within the HFPA who want to see this happen, who just either they got in for a little bit, like Theo Kingma was a reformist who became the president for, or executive director, whatever the top job is, for a couple of years, but then he was, you know, voted out, and then the same old guard came back in. So, you know, I always believe there's always more dirt to come out about the HFPA, but if they do these things, that will be a big change. It will. And so I think it will help. And we'll see. That's pretty much where I'm at right now. But I will say the fact that 74 out of 87 people voted for these reforms, which some of which will be painful for them, suggests that they finally got it, that it's this or they're going head first over a cliff.
So, no, I agree. Step in the right direction.
Yeah. Okay. So many are calling on CNN to fire Rick Santorum, the former senator who now serves as a political analyst for the cable news network. Santorum made some pretty dumb comments last week when he said, among other things, that there, quote, isn't much Native American culture in American culture, close quote, during his remarks at the Standing Up for Faith and Freedom conference. Santorum then appeared on Chris Cuomo's show on CNN on Monday, and instead of apologizing for his comments, he simply, you know, he said he misspoke. That lack of contrition set Don Lemon off, another host on CNN, of course, and he said of Santorum's remarks, quote, I was furious watching that interview in my office, and I cannot believe the first words out of his mouth weren't, I'm sorry I said something ignorant, I need to learn about the history of this country. No contrition. He didn't talk about the suffering that Native Americans have had to deal with, really. So, Daniel, what should CNN do about Rick Santorum?
Well, I think what they're doing now, which is nothing, is not the right answer. They have yet to comment publicly about him at all, and I don't think that's making anyone happy. I'm of two minds of this. I don't agree with what he said. I think what he said was stupid, and I think he should have apologized. I don't like Rick Santorum. I don't really care one way or another if he stays or goes. What I want to try and avoid, you know, I'm a liberal person, so I watch MSNBC and I watch CNN. Those are my networks of choice. But that doesn't mean I don't want to hear conservative voices, because right. I like knowing what's happening on the other side. I think if I'm just listening to people I agree with, what am I ever learning? Am I ever going to get anything out of that? Personally, no. So I don't want this to be a situation where, you know, we're just going to get rid of the conservative because he said something he didn't like, and we're just not going to have that kind of voice anymore, because I think it's important. I like hearing from both sides, whether I agree or disagree. I think that's the key.
So just pass over it.
Well, no, they have to do something. My guess is they'll get rid of him. I don't think Rick Santorum is worth fighting for. If it's, you know, aggravating your base that much. But what I don't want to see is, I'd like to see him replaced with a different conservative voice, if that's the way they go, because I do think that is
maybe really Liz Cheney key. Will have some time on her hands very soon.
She might.
Yeah, I mean, she'll still be in Congress. But I don't have a strong opinion about it either. I always feel like he was sort of the resident apologist during the Trump years, and it was really increasingly hard with every passing month of the Trump administration for him to find a leg to stand on, argument-wise. If you're not going to, as many have pointed out, if you're not going to embrace straight-up lies and straight-up conspiracy theories that are probably planted by a Russian misinformation campaign, then it is very hard to be a thoughtful conservative Republican these days. I wouldn't say conservative because that's just a philosophy, but it's hard to be a thoughtful Republican. And I don't think that he does a great job at it anyway. So maybe just find somebody new. But the truth is, Rick Santorum could easily, if he wanted to, just say, of course, I understand that Native American culture is fundamental to this country and I shouldn't have diminished it. It'd be pretty easy to say that.
And it's just always easy to apologize, and yet some people just dig in their heels more.
Good point.
But yeah, we'll see what happens. It's been like a week, and they've still done nothing. It's kind of surprising that they've passed the buck.
Yeah, but it might blow over.
It might. Maybe that's what they're waiting for.
He's not. I mean, he's not that powerful a person. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. I agree. I think I don't know why you'd fight for it. Like, is that the person you're really going to fight for?
Right. Right.
Santorum.
Yeah.
All right. Finally, this week, Caitlyn Jenner's campaign for the governor of California is off to a rocky start. First, she angered the trans community by saying she didn't think it was fair to have transgender girls competing in girls' sports at schools. Then she released a 3-minute campaign video where she referred to herself as a, quote, compassionate disruptor, end quote, which many people scoffed at. I don't even know what that phrase means. Then she appeared on Sean Hannity's show this week where she mistakenly said that she's pro-illegal immigration and told a bizarre story about friends at her airplane hangar saying they are leaving California because they don't like looking at homeless people. Way to sound relatable there. Sharon, California has a history of electing celebrities to office, so I can't just dismiss Caitlyn Jenner out of hand. Do you think she has any chance here?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, if she continues to say wacky things, and if she continues to alienate the trans community, then I don't think she'll be taken seriously as a candidate. But I do think that there is a fair amount of animosity toward Gavin Newsom. California, as most everybody knows, is a solid, solid blue state, Democratic state. But Caitlyn Jenner, you know, hits that sort of sweet spot of being a social, you know, that's that what compassionate disruptor means, right? Like a socially liberal. I mean, she's trans for one thing. She was married to the Kardashian clan as a man, as Bruce Jenner, for so many years, and so has sort of the Hollywood network and friends and all of that, and is more like in the libertarian spirit of conservatism, which has a strong constituency, even very much in Silicon Valley. There's a lot of that. People who hew to that idea. And I think there's even people in Hollywood who hew to that idea of, you know, less government. They're not, it's not monolithic here. The Democrats are not all super progressive, government pay for everything. So I think it does depend on if she can thread that needle, if she could bring in people who are sort of social liberals, again, like I don't know why you would go, you know, put your stake in the ground around, you know, girls and transgender girls in sports. That just seems like a bad place to start. But it's California, so I wouldn't rule anything out. And that's exactly, by the way, how Arnold Schwarzenegger got elected, yeah. Right? He was
same thing, runoff too.
Yeah, so very much a libertarian, right? Side kind of small government coming out of Eastern Europe, where the Soviet Union was the big brother hovering over everything, but a social liberal.
So. Yeah, she says socially liberal and fiscally conservative, which to your point, I think there is a needle to thread there, especially in California. But I'm not sure what she thinks her base is at the moment.
Exactly.
Her I don't base know is what, you celebrity. Know, what, which, but that's celebrities normally super liberal and she's not. It's very strange. So best of luck. It'll certainly be entertaining to say the least.
Yeah. Well,
all right. As always,
counting on that. Yes.
Yeah. We shall see. All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor in chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to sound off about something she is particularly into this week, her wax on, and something maybe she's a little more angry about or riled up about, her wax off. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
Why, thank you. So my wax on this week is about Donald Trump and major social media platforms. I think it's terrific that Donald Trump remains banned from Facebook and remains banned from Twitter. I think it's terrific that Twitter figured out that somebody was trying to repost Donald Trump's tweets and kick that person off the platform for trying to circumvent their decision. And I think it's great that the Oversight Board upheld Facebook's decision to remove Donald Trump from the platform. I think it's really important that we continue to be debating and pressuring the great social media monoliths now about what their policies are in terms of being a haven for hate speech, being a haven for misinformation, and or being the opposite, a haven for spreading good information and connecting people, which is supposedly what they're supposed to be about, giving everybody a voice. So I would just say, glad to know that Donald Trump is not going to be penetrating my consciousness again at 7 a.m. every morning as he did for 4 years, which was a completely unwelcome intrusion into my brain. Very glad that we can keep them at arm's length if you want to. My wax off is really shocking to watch what is happening in the Republican Party. I am neither a Republican nor a Democrat, but I do believe that a two-party system is really important for the maintenance of a healthy democracy. We need a party that's in government and a party that can push back against that. And it's that balance of power that keeps us healthy, that keeps us from falling into the corruption that a single party system tends to promote. The current Republican Party, which is now apparently planning to remove Liz Cheney from leadership because she insists on telling the truth that the November election in 2020 was not stolen from Donald Trump, that there was not fraud, that he did not actually win the election, and that she insists that going on about there being a big lie is a poison in the bloodstream of our democracy, which is the word that she used, that for that, for having that principled position, she needs to be removed from leadership of the Republican Party in Congress. That is very, very worrying, very worrying. And what we're seeing, and I've seen so many opinion columnists this week writing about it with a great deal of worry, everybody from Thomas Friedman to, you know, who's kind of middle of the road, to right-leaning, more conservative columnists, that there is, that the Republican Party is basically a non-functioning political organization today, and it has bought into and given over its conscience and its principles to Donald Trump still for no apparent reason. So I can only hope for the health of our democracy and for the sake of our two-party system, which has sustained us for so many decades and well over a century, that we figure out, that the Republicans figure out a path to a principled and sensible set of a philosophy that drives its policy agenda. That's it. How about you?
I like to wax on and off about the same thing when I can. I'm efficient. LA County has reached the yellow tier, which I'm really excited about. You know, basically, you know, we're headed in the right direction. We're doing all the right things. Things get to open up just a little more. This is mostly about you know, capacity requirements, like things are lifting up a little bit, you know, certain things can go from 25 to 50, et cetera, et cetera. But the off part, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. If you still don't have your two shots in 2 weeks, like don't go and do an indoor bar yet. You're not ready. Wait till you're fully vaccinated. So I'm excited that things are opening up. I'm very pro small business. It's been a rough year for them. I'm looking forward to visiting some of the places that I used to before when it's fully safe. But like, let's not stampede back into those indoor bars just yet. Let's go a little slowly but surely.
Well, it's spring. We can hang out outdoors too. So
I know. Well, yeah, I live right around the corner from Brennan's, which has a huge outdoor area, and it's been packed for a while now. And that's always kind of scared me, but the tables are all distance and everyone's outdoors, so it should be good. But
there was a great piece in The Atlantic this week. I'm just going to give you guys an extra on your wax on, wax off about
bonus edition.
Bonus edition, liberals who are clinging to their masks and who are clinging to their desire to hang on to all the COVID era restrictions despite the science. And it's sort of like the flip side of the people who are anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers despite the science, that there's a flip side of people who use the COVID restrictions. I mean, I see it myself and I observe it and I look at it and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense based on what we're seeing the science tell us. And there's one thing that's just people who are just anxious. And this is a piece about people who are hanging on, clinging to it is like it's part of their political identity, like hanging on to your mask. So eventually, really, guys, you can take it off, but take your time.
Yes, we're almost there. We're almost there. All right, that'll do
it
for
this week. I'm gonna argue with you there. If you are fully vaccinated, are there.
I'm I think I guess I have a few more days till I'm
two shots in two weeks. So, two shots in 2 weeks. All right.
Two and
well,
two.
We'll celebrate.
Oh, I can't wait. All right. That will do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we'll discuss the accusations surrounding ICM partners and dig into Facebook's latest decision on Donald Trump. Stick around.
So in the wake of an LA Times expose of ICM Partners, the leading Hollywood talent agency, where there were numerous cases of alleged sexual harassment and bad behavior. So in the wake of that, some of us wondered if this would make a moment to bring change to the entertainment industry and a bullying culture that is very longstanding and well accepted. So The Wrap dug in on this question and found the answer to be a little complicated. Here to discuss this very issue are The Wrap's film editor, Beatrice Verhoeven, and our reporter, Umberto Gonzalez, who wrote the piece this week. Welcome to Beatrice and Umberto.
Thanks.
So this expose, which Umberto scooped everybody on, the fact that it was even coming, and there was a lot of interest around the fact that, oh my God, what is this expose gonna say? When it came out, there was a little bit of a, response to it. And you guys took the day and talked to folks all over town. I had some people who just independently just sent me gossip or their reactions. But Umberto, what did you find? Start with you.
As a treat to your viewers, as we were ahead of the story before it published, this has been percolating in agency circles for weeks now. Mm-hmm. From my sourcing, Wendy Lee worked on this story for 7 months. Spent on this story, talking to the 30 or so individuals that came forward. And then that's how I got wind of it when I was on vacation last week. Hey, this is coming. So basically...
What was the reaction that you got when it finally did come out?
Brutally honest, like from eight, this is it, really? This? That's what they, really? Mm-hmm. You know? So it's the problem.
Why do you think that was their response? And did that surprise you that was their response?
It didn't surprise me because I think this problem is systemic all around entertainment companies in Hollywood. Think about it. We have shows like Entourage where Ari Gold is, when he's not with Vince, he's harassing his assistant Lloyd.
Right.
And that went on for multiple seasons.
Right.
For fun. That's already widely accepted, though, and including a lot of my sources, like who were assistants 20 years ago. It's like, oh, I went through much worse. Or you didn't work for this agent or that agent. Oh, that's nothing. Like, I'm talking, you have to walk a dog, or you got to pick up the dog's poo in the agent's office, or like do errands and stuff, or get yelled at.
Well, let's
it's been widely accepted.
All right, but the allegations, there's a whole mix of them, right?
Yes.
So what were some of the allegations, Beatrice, that were in this story?
Yeah, so they interviewed, half a dozen people. There were allegations of, a partner berating female agent until she cried, agents making derogatory comments to their assistants, executive asking Black support staffers to pose as agent trainees, agents making unwanted advances, sexual harassment as, an agent apparently exposing himself in a car. So very, very intense.
That doesn't sound great for sure. So I'll ask you the same question I asked Umberto. Are you surprised that people were not more shocked and, said like, oh my God, this has to end?
Kind of like Umberto said, unfortunately, this is like behavior that's instilled in Hollywood. We saw it with Scott Rudin. We see it with other big bosses where it's kind of like, if you can work for these people, you can survive anything and go to any job after that. And it's kind of like, it's just kind of this behavior that's for some reason accepted. And now more people are talking out about it. And now it's kind of like putting a lens on like revamping workplace behavior. Mm-hmm. But I will say, when Scott Rudin, the whole story broke, I spoke to Stephen Galloway, who did a profile on Scott Rudin 10 years ago and is now the dean of Chapman University's film school. And he said that nothing's really going to change until the bullying movement takes kind of... gains momentum as Me Too did and like Time's Up did and Black Lives Matter, because after Ellen last summer where, she was accused of workplace misconduct and
harassment. Ellen DeGeneres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That just kind of didn't gain as much momentum. So nothing's really going to change until the bullying momentum gains traction, which I thought was very interesting of him to say.
Yeah, I think that that's a big question as to whether the accusations about sexual harassment and problems of racism, systemic racism, which we've been talking about for a few years now, whether bullying is going to be elevated to that level. In some ways, I have to say it is regarded, and I am not endorsing this, but it is regarded as a badge of honor in some ways that you can take it or that you're up for it. Or, but then on the other hand, like, you know, I have a son who was an assistant for 2.5 years at a management company who's who shall remain nameless. And some of it just feels like, you know, because I would hear the stories on a daily, not on a daily basis, but on a regular basis, that it's just meant to assert power. And just like that whole idea we talk about male patriarchy, you know, and the
marking
established
territory.
Say again?
Marking territory, if you will.
Something like that. There's some, you know, when you, somebody used the word entitlement on here, I don't know who it was, but that there's some kind of sense of wanting to do that as a, some kind of ritualistic thing. That's really sick, actually, you know?
Yeah. That reminds me of that part of Scott Rudin where one of the assistants was like, he wanted a different salad every day. And then I would bring him the salad and it'd be wrong. So I just ordered all the salads in the morning and had it on his desk like 2 minutes later. And then he was like, I don't want this, and threw it away. So that's just a complete, you know, like showcasing of power.
But then he brought him the up. But the brilliant part was that I want another one. Exactly. He brought him the next one in 5 minutes. He's like, how the hell did you do that? But you also think like, well, that person's going to be successful in the entertainment industry, right?
For sure.
Unless he checks his expense report and sees why you're buying 10 salads every day.
So true.
Well, I mean, but I it's, you know, it's the same thing with the Meryl Streep, the Anna Wintour movie, very similar, right? That the hazing in the fashion industry, any competitive industry. The question is, I thought one of the things that was most interesting in your article was the comment from somebody who was anonymous about it being a generational thing, that people are going to age out of this. But I don't only think you age out of it if you decide that that's not how you want to be anymore. Otherwise, it just becomes like a tradition, like a fraternity thing that gets handed down in a way. I don't know. Umberto, what do you think?
That was my source who said that. But put it this way, every single one of my agency sources, every single one has been on the receiving end of some sort of hazing ritual, abuse, or yelling. And on one hand, yes, it does make you tougher, that you could last it out. But on the other hand, it's disturbing. I mean, and it's so entrenched in our business. You bring up patriarchy and entitlement. I'll give you a perfect example. And a very powerful film executive with green light power, actually. I'll keep it at that. One time at a premiere, came up to me upset over a story I did, and I didn't like his tone, and he was half my size. And I kindly reminded him, sir, first of all, watch your tone with me because you're not talking to your assistant. And he got taken aback very seriously, very quickly.
Wow.
Because he realized like I'd probably take him for a round or two without even trying. But I get a lot of that, quite frankly. There's a lot of
I would prefer not getting reports back if you're like getting into a fist fight at a film premiere now that we're finally coming out of confinement. But
No. But the
continue.
And we're all cool, everything's cool, but it's like sometimes you have to assert, you know, they like you said, they like to assert mark territory, assert power. And I'm just not with that, you know, quite frankly, you know, this town's full of corporate tough guys and, you know, not really street tough guys. But still, it's just interesting that they carry this attitude even outside their office or their agency or whatnot.
I'd be curious. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that the same culture is true at the networks and the studios, the major studios. It really seems to me to feel like it's very much focused in the talent agencies and the management companies. Do you think that's true?
I think it's somewhat true.
I have no idea.
I think that's somewhat true. I think mostly at agencies and management companies, because it's been long established. Like, I'm not going to name a name, but an agency source that I was talking to yesterday said, like, if you're going to look at these agents at ICM, you have to look at the previous culture and the trendsetters who come from WME, who set this culture to begin with maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's been systemic for a very long time, quite frankly.
Mm. I wonder how, yeah, I mean, how do we change it? Go ahead, Beatrice.
That's the same with, like, you know, the Scott Rudin situation. Like, everyone I talked to was like, that's the old generation of how stuff got done. And it's very strange, but I can't think of another example right now off the top of my head, but, you know, there are so many examples where this older generation of Hollywood executives and producers, that's how they did stuff, and it's not changing for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was true around sexual harassment, right? And if that's finally become unacceptable, if that can become unacceptable, I have to think that bullying can be made unacceptable as well. And there can be another way of setting the bar high for a competitive industry that a lot of people want to be in, and you have to prove your persistence and you have to prove your resourcefulness and ingenuity and you can take it and all that stuff without destroying people.
I mean, you just said, like, is this going to change? And, like, you know, we talk about this a lot, Sharon. HFPA, you know, was accused of bullying themselves. You know, they have gotten so much backlash in the past couple months, even couple years, but, you know, rightfully so. And now they're really taking it seriously. And they're, you know, they voted today to reform and do these drastic changes to, you know, increase diversity, all that stuff. They're changing.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
It does seem like the pandemic has sort of put mental health into a different focus than it used to be. It seems that, you know, we can easily draw the line at sexual harassment. We can easily draw the line at racism. We can easily draw the line about assault and things like that. But mental health is kind of one of those things where we're like, it's fine. But I don't think it is anymore. I think there's sort of an increased discussion about this. And you know, we talked about it last week, Sharon. I think bullying and that sort of environment is kind of the next Me Too, if you will. And I think this is proof of that.
But it's going to take a while. I think it'll take the longest out of all three. Out of the Me Too, sexual harassment, this will take the longest because it has to come from the top down, from the agency bosses to the coordinators, to the heads of the department, then to the agency ranks, to the assistant ranks, and then to the mailroom, quite frankly. I mean, look, there's even books written about this, surviving the mailrooms, you know, and there's horror stories galore in there. But it has to come from the top down, from like Lovett, Silberman, all these guys, and then it'll permeate throughout the agency. But it's going to be, I'm sure it could happen because, quite frankly, this generation is not taking it. And won't stand for it, and I can respect that, but it's going to take a while, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think to your point, one of the quotes that I think you got in the story, that the toxic behavior is a byproduct of previous generations that will inevitably age out, and that'll be interesting to see if that's how it plays out.
Nice. Right, Beatrice.
Yeah, make for a good movie, maybe. All right, Beatrice and Berto, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
It was an up and down week for Donald Trump on social media. His Facebook ban remains in place, but there are still some unanswered questions there. And his attempt to create a new social platform was mostly ridiculed and actually resulted in another Twitter ban. Here to help us dig in on all things Trump and social media is the Wraps tech reporter, Sean Birch. How's it going, Sean?
Going well. Thanks for having me back, guys.
Happy to be talking Trump again. Did you miss him?
Yeah, I think I went about, at least on our side, I went about a solid 12 hours without covering a online thing before this came down on Wednesday. So it was a nice little reprieve.
Yeah, it's nice to have his word vomit back in our lives. Sean, in your analysis of the Facebook Oversight Board's decision, you wrote, quote, "The board, which was supposed to provide clarity on Facebook's censorship decisions, provided confusion instead," end quote. Yeah. Explain to us what you meant by that.
Yeah, put quite well, I must say.
If you say so yourself about your writing.
Yeah, not too shabby.
Well done, self.
Facebook's oversight board this week, which is a 20-person independent board that's pretty much there to review any content decisions that Facebook makes, major ones, that is. So for this, it was referred to Facebook's oversight board. They came back and said Facebook was, quote, justified in getting rid of Donald Trump because he broke their rules. However, they said that the company needs to give him either full-on ban, just kick him off completely, or give him a time limit. And in that sense, I said it was a bit of a cop-out because
yeah.
the point of the oversight board was to take it out of Mark Zuckerberg's hands. That's why he spent literally hundreds of million, you know, $130 million. Right. He spent a ton of money on this to pretty much just say, look, for the last few years, I've been getting it from one side saying I'm not censoring enough content. Others have said I'm taking down too much content. So this was a way for him to say, look, I'm not doing this anymore. It's hands off. And yet somehow it still came back and it's going to be his decision now whether Donald Trump is going to stick around or not.
Which, by the way, makes total sense. These people, an oversight board, they're not shareholders. They're not duly elected officers. They're not the board of directors. They're not, they're, you know, like some Olympian committee. To have such a powerful, I would think that what they should be there for in general, for taking aside this particular instance, mm-hmm. is to bring a diversity of thought and opinion from around the world, you know, bring their expertise and make a high level recommendation to the people who are paid to run the company. But that just takes you back to the big problem, which is there's basically one person who runs this company who doesn't want to run a content company, who doesn't want to have to fundamentally, doesn't want to have to be an arbiter of speech, and who really, you know, should have thought about that when he started friggin' Facebook, because that's what he built. And it's made him a bazillionaire and one of the most powerful people on earth. He's the single largest shareholder. He answers to nobody and he doesn't want to deal with this issue. So sorry if I sound like a little worked up, but I am worked up because I've been worked up about Mark Zuckerberg for many years. Like, nice guy, dude, but the stuff that you do impacts all of us and is having a very corrosive effect on democracy. So I actually totally agree with your analysis about it, Sean. It's like they pass the buck back to Mark Zuckerberg. They're keeping Trump off the platform, but it doesn't resolve the fundamental question that sits on Mark Zuckerberg's desk. What are you going to do about the misinformation and hate and the sometimes violence-inducing speech that can happen and sort of that can undermine actual democracy, but also has impacted a much narrower level on smaller groups of people from so it goes from the highest to the lowest. Mark, what are you going to do about it?
Well, I think this group, they basically sort of acted like a court of appeals in a way. And they basically said, you were right to make the ban. You had every right to do that. The only part that you screwed up is indefinite. They basically went through and said the Facebook laws rule book states that you have to pick a span of time. That was the only part they really sort of kicked back to them, right?
Right. And but what me and Sharon have been saying, at least, you know, we talked about this yesterday.
Right.
That, you know, what's the point then of having this board?
Exactly.
These really needy decisions, right? These tough decisions, they're going to pretty much half-ass it, right? There's no other way to put it. They gave you half an answer on this one. They threw it back to Zuckerberg and said, all right, you have 6 months now to figure out what you want to do.
To figure it out, right.
Right. And at this point, this Trump story with Facebook is turning into like the never-ending story, right? We're already 4.5 months into this. I mean, do we really need a year to determine whether or not you want to keep them around or not? I have my personal opinions on like how I would run it if I were Facebook. But at this point,
you
do? I'm going to make a call, right?
Okay, wait. If Sean Birch ran Facebook, what would he do?
Would it cost less than $130 million to get the answer?
I don't got that type of scratch, but
you'd be getting them.
Watches Tech Talk on Rap Pro would know. I'm a bit more of a free speech absolutist. Usually, I'm not a big fan of kicking people off of these platforms, especially when, at the moment, he was the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And whether you like it or not, I didn't vote for him. He still was the president at the time. I think it's worth hearing what the actual president has to say, even when it can be batshit crazy. Sorry if I
could. I'm definitely in the column with you as a free speech absolutist. But when there is demonstrated harm by somebody's speech, then I think you have to draw the line. I mean, it totally goes to the category of yelling fire in a crowded theater, you know. And it was actually Liz Cheney, of all people, who said that Donald Trump lit the match that set off the explosion in the Capitol on January 6th. It's literally the same analogy that, you know, words can set off real life acts of violence, which we know. So I think there has to be a line drawn at some point. January 6th was totally demonstrable. I think you might have, but I also would say that when you have, when an election is at stake, you could just say, we're not going to host political speech after a certain point, once the voting starts, or, you know, you could pick certain dates, you know, in a campaign and try to keep free space, you know, from political influence one way or the other, the same way that I don't think broadcast television allows political ads after a certain, you know, once the voting starts, you can't run a campaign ad anymore. It's really very similar. And we figured it out with mass communication tools before, and so there's no reason why you can't figure out with this kind of mass communication, except that the government's been very slow to regulate or step in, and they have not figured out how to self-regulate or really shown much, you know, sincerity about. And I'm not denying it's a complex problem. There's something else I want to bring up, by the way, which is, how much does it matter? You know, this question occurred to me yesterday. If Trump's on or off Facebook, I mean, Twitter was his weapon of choice, you know, and he's off Twitter.
I believe he had 88 million followers on Twitter when he was kicked off. And at Facebook at the same time, he was kicked off pretty much the same day. He had, I think, 50 something million followers on Facebook and another 30 plus on Instagram, which is owned by Facebook. So, as you know, to your point, he had the same following on Twitter that he had across both Facebook platforms.
But does that still mean people react or check in? It doesn't tell you engagement. You may have, that's how many subscribers you may have. That doesn't mean everybody's looking at it at any given time. Whereas I find Twitter to be a much more viral in the moment, kind of reactive platform, communication platform.
No, you're right. But I think one of the main headaches I've had covering this issue is that, you know, these decisions oftentimes are just so arbitrary. So if we're going to talk about Twitter, you know, they kick off Trump and, all right, you're a private company, that's your call. But if you look at what they leave up, right, so every week you can find a just absolutely terrible tweet from Chinese state media, which is allowed to go on. You can find these dictators on there. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like, I don't know, if you're going to kick off some of these people, you might as well kick them all off or not kick them off at all. Just, again, it seems.
Well, I think there have been definitely calls for that. I think that in places like Myanmar or places, you know, some South Asian countries and in South America, human rights activists have called and democracy advocates have called on Facebook to take measures where in most places they have not. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the need for moderating or taking action is limited to this country. It's of course very true and problematic. You know, you can whip up a mob in no time if you have the right, you know, following on Facebook, on Twitter, I mean, so, or Facebook, but Twitter especially. And I think that's, you know, it's just the power that's been unleashed by these platforms is just kind of, it would have been hard to predict, but we're seeing the real life consequences.
Right. And I think you're seeing now that, you know, at least here in the States, they're trying to catch up to that, the government, that is. So we actually have on this point a fair amount of bipartisan support, where House Democrats last fall came out with a report saying Amazon, Facebook, companies like that are just too big. You know, Facebook has 1.8 billion people using it every single day, and they may need to be regulated like the phone companies are, where, and that's the Republican side of things now, where they say they're too big at this point. They control online speech to a point where if you kick someone off, you're not going to hear from these people ever again. Look at someone like Milo Yiannopoulos, right, from a few years ago.
Yeah, right. Remember him.
He gets kicked off Twitter. He gets off kick off Facebook. Next thing you know, I can't even remember the last time I heard about this guy. Maybe when he was on Bill Maher a few years ago, right? So they have a lot of sway over our discourse, and you're actually starting to see both sides come together and say, is this do we want them to have such a concentrated amount of power?
So are you now the free speech absolutist supporting government regulation?
I go back and forth on that one every single day, because the argument on the other side, right, is that these are private companies, no matter how big they are, and they make their own rules. You know, so if Facebook wants to kick them off.
Well, I mean, they're not private companies. Facebook is a public company,
Pardon me, yes.
But I know what you meant.
Yes. So in that sense, I mean, that is a fair argument to me. So I go back and forth on this one every single day. I do think the argument that these companies are getting to a point where they're so big that if you get kicked off just a couple of these platforms, you're pretty much erased from the internet. I think that is a valid concern. And we can point to something recently, which is Parler, right? We've been covering Parler because their policies weren't in lockstep with what Apple liked, with what Amazon liked. They lost their web hosting, right? They were kicked off both Google and Apple's app stores. And at that point, the argument doesn't just boil down to you're a company, you can decide your own rules. At that point, you're saying this company has to also build their own hosting, build their own internet, essentially. And that might be a bridge too far.
So the Trump Twitter ban actually kind of got reignited this week a little bit in a roundabout way. So he created his own, I think he tried to call it a social platform. He launched a blog on his website. And someone, according to the Trump people, not someone affiliated with Trump, created a sort of an automated Twitter account that then took those posts and put them on Twitter, and Twitter banned that account. What do you think of that decision?
Well, you could kind of see this coming, because when we wrote about this story a couple of days ago on The Wrap, you know, we pointed out right away that, hey, even though on this blog of Trump's, it's only his messages, you can click an icon right underneath each message and it'll share it to your Facebook account or your Twitter account. And you kind of sat back and go, that seems like it's going to maybe, you know, we're going to run into an issue here in the next few days. So you're right. There wasn't a Twitter account that was resharing everything he was posting. It was immediately taken down by Twitter on Thursday.
So do you think that was the right decision?
It was just a runaround.
Exactly.
But it wasn't Trump that was doing it, according to his people. It was just someone created an account that just took those posts and put them on Twitter. But they ruled it was sort of a circumvention of the ban.
Right. But here's the confusing part about it, Dan. So, yes, they take down the account that's sharing everything Trump says, and they say you're not allowed to do that. But then Lindsay Ellefson, one of our reporters here, she came back and got the answer from Twitter saying that journalists and other people can share what Trump is saying. And again, it just seems a bit arbitrary, right? So an account can't share it, but
no, it's not. That's not arbitrary. That means you're not dumb. I mean, the point of that particular Twitter account was simply to repost Trump's comments. I mean, that just shows some intelligent discernment, as far as I can tell. I mean, I've actually seen journalists get taken off of Twitter for citing, you know, something slightly offensive as reporters, and that part is very confusing. But I mean,
there seems to be a bit of a hole in their argument, which is that, like, let's say for whatever reason I decided to myself keep resharing everything Trump said on Twitter. It seems like because I'm a journalist, they're going to let me do that. So I'm just saying, to me, it seems
if you decided to hand over your Twitter account to Donald Trump and repost everything, then you are not behaving as a journalist.
Well, no, but.
Or a rational human being, but that's neither here
nor there. whatever. I think that these questions are, as we've said before, they are vastly complicated. And I wish we had somebody, you know, Jack Dorsey has shown himself to be a much more thoughtful leader on this issue than Mark Zuckerberg. And I think Mark Zuckerberg just, you know, hopes and prays that somebody will take this problem off his hands. And he discovered this week that nobody's going to solve that problem for him. He's going to have to solve it himself.
That's why he gets paid the big bucks.
Yeah.
All right, John, thank you so much for joining us today, helping us break this down. You know, you can always read Sean's expert analysis, his words, not mine, on Wrap Pro, which is a members-only offering from The Wrap and an essential news source for the entertainment business. Wrap Pro was designed specifically for Hollywood insiders who want to stay on top of the business of movies, TV, and streaming, and includes exclusive access, news, and insights like Sean's that are not available anywhere else. For more information and to subscribe to Wrap Pro now, visit therap.com/join. Thanks again, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to rate us and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.